progress will always come from Demos, from we the people.
Greece has made a tremendous comeback. We've worked with them very closely.
The United States recognizes only one legitimate government of the Republic of Cyprus.
Nothing can break the spirit of the Greek people.
Long live the friendship between Greece and the United States of America. Ευχαριστώ. Thank you very much.
I'm Thanos Davelis, and this is The Greek Current. Last week, President Trump hit Russia's biggest oil producers, Rosneft and Lukoil, with sanctions, a move many see as a major shift from the Trump administration that puts it on the same page as Europe when it comes to pressuring Moscow. Lawrence Norman, the European reporter for The Wall Street Journal, joins me as we look at this shift from President Trump and break down what it means for Europe and the war in Ukraine. Lawrence, great to have you back on The Greek Current.
Nice to be here.
Lawrence, is this announcement, as you see it from the White House, as big of a shift as many are making it out to be when it comes to the administration's approach to Russia?
So I would break my answer into two parts. I think the actual impact of the measures themselves and then the political impact. I think on the measures themselves, we're really yet to see. I mean, obviously, we've had 3.5 years of heavy sanctions pressure from the US and Europe. All kinds of entities hit, you know, the financial sector, energy, etc. It's not clear how big an impact this set of sanctions against Rosneft and Lukoil will have. It's a lot of that is about enforcement and political will. So I think we're yet to see on the actual how much damage will it do to Russia's economy. It clearly will not help. And it hits Russia's soft spots, which is the absolutely crucial income that it receives from energy and from oil for its budget, which allows it to continue the war. But let's wait and see on that side. We can come back to that. I think then the political impact is bigger. Putin has had his best possible scenario of US basically losing interest in the war, at times seeming to side with Putin's narrative, and a massive split between US and the Europeans, who are now basically paying the entire financial burden of the war at a time that is economically difficult for Europe. That's his best scenario. So the fact that the US and the Europeans are now working together, it's not just they're doing sanctions at the same time, they're actually working together on this. And you have some other areas of alignment now about how the war should end between the Trump administration and Europe. That's a problem for Putin. And I think in some ways that political impact is as important as anything else. If, and this is the big if, as always with the Trump administration, if they stay the course, and one never knows.
I want to stick with the impact of the measures. What factors should we be looking out for when we assess whether they'll make a difference?
Yeah, I mean, obviously the oil price is going to be one indicator of whether these measures are hitting. There was a big rise in the oil price in the market. I mean, at the end of the day, what it comes back to is how much of a drop is there in the revenue that the Russian federal budget is able to take from oil, which Lukoil is a private company, but they pay obviously hefty taxes, and it makes up, the oil contribution to the budget makes up about a third of the total. So ultimately what we want to see is that drop. And one way that that can drop is Russia is restricted in the amount of oil it can sell. And so we have Chinese and Indian refineries giving some indication that they won't buy Russian oil after these measures. We'll have to see again if that lasts. Another indicator, and this in many ways has been the most real impact that a lot of the sanctions have had, is simply to raise the cost for Russia of doing its oil business. The risk goes up, the risk to vessels that are carrying their oil, they charge a higher premium. The customers, as if they shrink, then can demand bigger discounts. And so there are various ways that this can play through that we can see in terms of how Russia is able to raise revenue for the war through its budget from oil. And we'll obviously be watching those very closely.
As you've reported, these sanctions are hitting the Russian economy at a rather precarious time. After defying sanctions for over 3 years, where is Russia's economy today? You talked about the difficulty of doing business for Russian oil companies, but what's the broader outlook for Russia's economy? And is this a sign that sanctions are actually working?
So I think that the Predictions of the collapse of the Russian economy have been too confident too many times in the last 3.5 years for anyone to be confidently saying that's what's going to happen. It's certainly not going to happen on the back of these sanctions alone. If there is increased pressure, if there is real enforcement on additional sanctions and the sanctions that have gone by, if the US really uses its sanctions power, then we could come back to that. But the Russian economy is not going to collapse. What the Russian economy is facing is a fairly typical problem of a war economy, added to all the problems that Russia had economically before the war, where it, despite decades of talking about diversifying, it essentially was its energy sector was absolutely critical to it. So what we have is we have massive defense spending, probably higher than the Russians are admitting. We have resources, labor, materials, technology going into the defense sector, starving the private sector of anything else. And we have inflation, as is typical of a overheated war economy, which is still pretty high. Interest rates are still, I think they came down last week, but they're still close to 20%. And that is not a long-term sustainable economy. However, the question, as always, with this war and with the Kremlin, is what price is Vladimir Putin prepared to pay to continue the war? Barring the complete collapse of the Russian economy and the kind of situation we saw in the late 80s and early 90s, it's pretty clear that Vladimir Putin is prepared to pay a very high price, both of men and economically, to continue this war. So you have, and you've had from the beginning, this ticking clock of how long can the Russian economy sustainably keep this up versus Putin's determination to continue fighting. And right now, I think we still don't know the answer, but it would be foolhardy to say that Putin cannot afford to prosecute this war for another couple of years at least.
Lawrence, you brought up China and India as one of Russia's big customers. But another country that's also buying a lot of Russian oil is Turkey, and President Trump has urged all of these countries to halt purchases of Russian oil. What can we expect from them, especially countries like Turkey, which are also NATO members, and Turkey is also still an EU candidate country. So this is also an angle that Europeans are watching closely as well, I'm assuming.
So I think to answer that, let's come back to the basics. What is it that the US can do apart from their own direct sanctions, which ban US transactions with Rosneft and Lukoil and the various other sanctions? What the US can do that no one else can do is to impose effectively their sanctions on the rest of the world. We've seen this with Iran. We've seen this to some extent with Russia. They can go around the world and say, we have these sanctions. You Chinese refinery cannot buy Russian oil under our sanctions. And if you do, we will hit the refinery, and we will hit whichever bank is doing the financial transaction for this and lock it out of the dollar system. Those secondary extraterritorial sanctions. Now, in each of these cases, China, India, and Turkey, there is a different set of leverage. And I think it's going to be very interesting to see when Xi meets Trump this week at ASEAN. What priority does Trump make the pressure on China not to buy Russian oil? Where does it fit in his list of priorities? They're pretty big on China. With India, we've seen that they've taken action. They put the sanctions. They clearly feel that they have the leverage, although so far, at least until now, Indian companies have not been complying. But there's probably some leverage. Now, the problem with Turkey is that everybody knows that they are a massive hub for Russian circumvention of sanctions, but everybody knows they are also an absolutely crucial player in this war. They are crucial for diplomacy. They are crucial for stopping shipping going in. It is crucial not to have Turkey leaning more to the Russian side as against the Ukrainian side, because they hold geographically, politically, economically an absolutely crucial role. And frankly, I don't see that there's a lot of leverage. So yes, the US and European officials visit Turkey. They present lists of items that they would press them not to bring in. They take some kind of enforcement measures. But I think Turkey knows, and Erdogan knows, he's in a position to deflect a lot of pressure, including sanctions pressure, because everybody needs him.
Lawrence, President Trump had previously said he would only impose further sanctions on Moscow if Europe completely stopped buying Russian energy. What's the big picture across Europe today when it comes to relying on Russian energy? Has that umbilical cord been cut?
It hasn't been cut. Of course, President Trump says many things, and he doesn't always follow through. And I think this is a case in point. The umbilical cord hasn't been cut. It has been narrowed significantly, if you can do that to umbilical cords. Europe is not buying any coal. It is buying much less gas than it was. The pipelines, obviously the Nord Stream pipelines to Germany, are not functioning one way or the other. Now, on oil, it's a more complicated picture, partly because we have the Druzhba oil pipelines providing oil to Hungary and to the Slovakia, to Czech Republic, and they on-pass it to other countries. We also have, obviously, Turkgas bringing in some gas in the south. And then, of course, we had the Europeans. As much as President Trump, you know, slammed India for buying Russian oil and then refining it, Europe was buying quite a lot of that. So both officially and unofficially, you know, Europe has continued to buy imports. I think the figure was around 20 billion euros worth of official kind of direct imports. And part of that was liquefied natural gas, which the Europeans have now said that they would phase out by the beginning of 2027. But all that said, this is much, much, much, much less than they were buying in 2021. And that has had an impact on Russia. And you can see that Russia's trying to now, China's finally given it permission to build the pipeline from Russia. That's going to take years and years and years. There's no doubt that that relationship has been ruptured. And there is legislation backed by sanctions that Europe is intending to not import any Russian fossil fuel by the end of 2027. We'll have to see if it meets that target or if the war ends and it gets made more flexible. But we are talking about a very different, far, far less dependent relationship on Russian energy now.
You know, beyond the shift that we've addressed from the Trump administration on Russia with these sanctions, are we also seeing Europe and the United States now come closer to a shared vision for how the war in Ukraine can end?
Yeah, I think this takes us back to the beginning. The question is, how determined is the Trump administration to press Russia to try and end the war versus how determined is the Trump administration to find a way to work with Russia and improve relations and do business ventures? And one sees both sides of this. But you do have two elements aligned now. In some ways, you have three. There's an acceptance in Europe that they're going to pay the bill. The Trump administration is not only, you know, is not giving any more packages of supply, and everything that is supplied to Ukraine militarily is now bought or is now being bought by Europe. So that's one level where Trump is happy and the Europeans have accepted that. So you have that, and that means a continued flow of weapons, which the US has said it will provide. The second area of alignment is they are now increasing sanctions pressure, as discussed. The third element of alignment, I think, is really critical. And again, we'll have to see if it lasts. Despite these various openings that the Americans, Steve Witkoff in particular, have had about getting to a ceasefire by Ukraine unilaterally, handing over territory in the Donbass region, that it's fairly clear that Witkoff believes is the only way to end it. The Russians have been demanding it, and Trump has kind of vacillated back and forth on this. I think it's dawning on the Americans that they can't do that. I think that that's a political ask of Zelensky that is impossible, and that strategically, it would be handing parts of Ukraine back that would simply make it much easier for Russia to go again at Ukraine in the future. And so there is this area of alignment, at least for now, where the way to end the war is along the current front line. And if you can get a ceasefire there and then move into peace talks, then you can start to put the pieces of that together. As long as the Americans were telling Ukraine to unilaterally hand over territory, then you had a split between the US on one side and Europe and Ukraine that frankly wasn't going to be resolved. I think the Ukrainians were clearly just going to keep fighting in that situation and turn around and say, well, the Europeans are buying the weapons anyway and providing us with money for the next 2 years, so that's what we'll do. So that, I think that area of alignment, as long as it sticks, is really important because it is a shared vision of how you get to at least a ceasefire. And we'll have to see whether those areas of alignment stick around.
Lawrence, great chatting with you as always. Thanks for joining us.
Pleasure. Thanks a lot.
Taking us to our headlines for the day, U.S. Interior Secretary and head of the National Energy Dominance Council, Doug Burgum, highlighted Greece's role in reducing Europe's dependence on Russian gas during an event titled Powering U.S. Energy Dominance. Burgum referred to his recent visit to Greece, particularly the Revithoussa LNG terminal, and emphasized the North-South axis and the 3+1 framework as key initiatives to advance this goal. Finally, a Turkish court has issued another formal arrest order for Istanbul's jailed mayor Ekrem İmamoğlu on suspicion of political espionage, state-owned Anadolu news agency said, stepping up a long-running opposition crackdown. İmamoğlu denies all charges against him. Hundreds of members and elected leaders of İmamoğlu's main opposition, Republican People's Party, face an array of corruption-related charges in a crackdown the party calls politicized and anti-democratic. That wraps up today's episode of The Greek Current. Thanks for tuning in.